Happy New Year, and welcome once again to the Marietta Daily Journal podcast. I'm Darren Sutherland. Here are the top stories starting 2021. John Ossoff, big rally for Cobb Hispanic voters in the final days before the election. Cobb links to resume fare collections real soon. Kemp pushes back at criticism over Trump's election. And part three of our interview with Alex Gilbert and former District Attorney Tom Sharon, only on the Marietta Daily Journal podcast. Engineer Solutions
of Georgia. Hey, Atlanta, this is Jay and Lewis, owners of Engineered Solutions of Georgia. Lewis, what should a homeowner do if they have a crack in their block wall, corner of their door, window, or concrete foundation?
Well, Jay, if it's a diagonal crack, this lets us know that they should be concerned and there could be a serious problem. Then they should call our office at 678-ESOG-NOW and set up an appointment to have one of our qualified professional technicians come out to their property to take a look at the problem.
I'm consumer investigator Dale Cardwell. I've done the research already, so you don't have to. You can trust Engineered Solutions of Georgia.
Give Engineered Solutions of Georgia a call at 678-ESOG-NOW.
Engineered Solutions of Georgia. We guarantee a stable, dry foundation.
Well, if you're tired of seeing TV commercials, you've got a few days left. Radio, you got a few days left. Print, you've got a few days left. Well, here's something you didn't know. In the final days before the January 5th runoff election, John Ossoff rallied voters in front of Super Mercata Market, La Villa, on Roswell Street, where over 100 supporters gathered at the Latina meet and greet event. It was pretty exciting, said Mr. Villalobos, who lives in Marietta and cast his ballot on the first day of early voting. There's a lot of political signs for Ossoff in his neighborhood, and there's definitely a lot of energy surrounding his campaign. Ossoff, who narrowly forced a runoff against Senator David Perdue, primarily stuck to his message of health, jobs, and justice. In the Q&A session following his stump speech, he addressed a number of issues specific to the Hispanic community. He said he would stand with all Dreamers and DACA recipients because Dreamers are every bit of American as any of us. Ossoff also said in response to a question about immigration policies, he pledged to support a pathway to citizenship for those who lack documentation and otherwise follow the law, and reiterated his opposition to cooperation between immigration authorities and local law enforcement. Ossoff went on to say at one point that the Trump administration's family separation policy constituted criminal actions. He said, "My business investigates war crimes, and if that happened, it is a war crime." Ossoff continued to attack the incumbents for their alleged insider trading ahead of the COVID-19 pandemic, calling Senator Perdue and Loeffler the Bonnie and Clyde of corruption in American politics. The rally took place just steps away from the Cobb County Republican Party headquarters Tuesday night. The GOP advertised the rally on its Facebook page, saying they would be giving Ossoff a proper Cobb GOP welcome. Everybody talks about Ossoff. His supporter says, and they're looking for a political victory. They definitely are indicating they want Georgia to reflect diversity.
Happy holidays from all of us at Credit Union of Georgia. This holiday season, remember, you deserve better than your bank. Better service, better rates, better solutions. That's why we've taken the time this year to revamp our online tools to give you the safest options when it comes to your money. Open a personal or business account in just minutes. We have new digital tools like our mobile app to make your life simpler. We offer auto loans from 1.89%. Need a mortgage? Our team can get you a home for the holidays. If you live or work in Cobb County, now is the perfect time to make the switch to Credit Union of Georgia, the better way to bank. Since 1960, Credit Union of Georgia has been providing Northwest Georgia with financial solutions that make sense for your home, business, and family. Become a member today or apply for a loan by visiting www.cuofga.org. That's www.cuofga.org. Credit Union of Georgia, the better way to bank.
Coblink's going to resume fare collections in January. That's right. The public transportation update in Cobb County. Fares will resume January the 11th. The county announced Wednesday Coblink buses have been free to ride since April 3rd when the county suspended its fare and implemented a rear door entry and exit policy in an attempt to promote better social distancing and protect its drivers from coronavirus. In making its announcement on social media, the county noted Coblink would be the last public transportation provider in Metro Atlanta to resume collecting fares. In August, East Cobb Commissioner Bob Ott said the system cost about $25 million to operate each year. Less than a quarter of the money comes from the passengers' fare. Half comes from the county's general fund, and federal grant covers the other 25 to 30%. Earlier this year, Coblink received $18 million through the CARES Act, the pandemic relief Congress passed in the spring. The money was meant to support operational expenses associated with the impact of COVID-19, which included covering the cost to maintain service, making up for lost revenue during the pandemic, purchase of special protective equipments for the drivers, according to the state. Marietta Church is providing free food for those in need on January 6th. That's right. Mark your calendar for January 6th as the Episcopal Church of St. Peter and St. Paul at 1795 Johnson Ferry Road in Marietta is partnering with There's Hope for the Hungry to provide free food for those in need. From 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., those in need can drive by, follow the signs through the church parking lot, and pick up a box of food that will be placed in their car. The food will feed up to 4 people for 2 weeks. What a great way to start the new year. Love and light for 2021.
You can search all over America, but you'll find America's largest gun store in Cobb County, Georgia. Adventure Outdoors, proud supporter of the Second Amendment and the red, white, and blue, with over 18,000 guns in stock every day. Did you know Adventure Outdoors is also home to one of Georgia's largest shooting ranges? The Remington Range, with basic range memberships starting at only $25 per month, which includes unlimited lane rental, 3 free firearm rentals per month, free shirt and hat, priority lane placement, and guest passes. Adventure Outdoors also offers family, corporate, and group plans. One of America's top shooting facilities is right here in Cobb County, and for only $25 a month, you can be a member and receive unlimited lane rentals and so much more. Support the Second Amendment and your right to own and bear arms, and practice and learn at Adventure Outdoors Remington Range today. Adventure Outdoors, South Cobb Drive in Smyrna, or online at adventureoutdoors.us.
Well, Governor Brian Kemp is pushing back, so to speak. On Wednesday, he said he's focused on Georgia's response to the corona pandemic and next week's runoff for the state's 2 U.S. Senate seats, calling everything else just a distraction. Brian Kemp was responding to the criticism leveled at him by President Donald Trump earlier Wednesday. In a Twitter post, Trump called on the Republican governor to resign for being what he termed an obstructionist in his refusal to interfere in awarding Georgia's 16 electoral college votes to President-elect Joe Biden. Trump continues to claim he carried Georgia in the November 3rd election, despite Biden winning nearly 12,000 more votes in the Peach State than the president. The results have been certified on several accounts, and no voter fraud has been found. Governor Kemp said, I've supported the president. I've worked as hard as anybody in the state for his reelection. But at the end of the day, I have to follow the law and the Constitution. Kemp said he's focused instead on getting Georgians stricken with COVID-19 who require hospitalization and a hospital bed help. He said public health officials are working to reopen the Georgia World Congress Center as an overflow care facility for coronavirus patients as soon as possible. Healthcare workers are also busy vaccinating Georgia nursing home patients in an effort that began earlier this week. Kemp said he's also working hard to ensure the reelection of Republican Senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler on January 5th to save our country from what he termed socialism, defunding the police, and the Green New Deal. echoing campaign themes the GOP incumbents have sounded in their campaigns against Democratic challengers John Ossoff and the Reverend Raphael Warnock. Kemp also defended the Georgia Bureau of Investigation against criticism by attorney Rudolph Giuliani, Trump's personal lawyer, and the former New York City mayor. Giuliani dismissed as a joke a signature match audit of absentee ballots this week in Cobb County that the GBI helped conduct that found no evidence of fraud. Kemp said he was glad Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger ordered the audit and that the GBI did a great job on it. The news conference came shortly after state lawmakers on the Georgia Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on Elections wrapped up a fourth hearing on the November 3rd election that rehashed disputed fraud claims and drew witnesses who had already testified at the Capitol in recent weeks. Giuliani was among the witnesses making a repeat appearance.
When you have experienced the loss of a loved one, you can trust Carmichael Funeral Home to guide you through the arrangements necessary to create a meaningful ceremony that celebrates the unique life being honored. At Carmichael Funeral Homes in Smyrna and Marietta, our staff is committed to providing your family with the highest quality care and service in your time of need. In addition, we take pride in our responsibility to lighten your burden as you take the first steps toward healing. No matter what your choice, we believe in lives lived well. Please contact us with any questions regarding your pre-arrangement requests. At Carmichael Funeral Homes in Smyrna and Marietta, individual attention, providing support to the community, healing lives and grieving hearts, and celebrating lives well lived are our privilege to help. Contact us today or visit us online at CarmichaelFuneralHomes.com. Celebrating memories you'll always cherish. Carmichael Funeral Homes.
Once again, I want to thank Alex Gilbert, MDJ staff writer, for his great interview with former Cobb County District Attorney Tom Sharon. If you haven't heard parts one and two, you can listen to previous editions of the Marietta Daily Journal podcast. This edition will complete the interview with former District Attorney Tom Sharon.
I think I'm done dealing with that.
We'll see.
Yeah, okay.
The folks at Welser are saying, you know, it's our policy right now because of COVID, we can't have people on site taking the pictures.
Oh, okay.
I don't think Louis will be very happy about that. So you might call me in a moment.
Okay.
Tell me to break down the doors at Welser if I have to. Anyway, so you think that contributed to the razor thin?
Yeah, I think so.
And what year was that case closed?
It closed would have been probably 79, 78 or 79.
Okay.
Because I took office in 77.
So towards the end of that first term.
Yeah, it was during the first term.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was still pretty untested, and I'm sure I made a lot, the office made a lot of mistakes. Not bad mistakes, but, you know, I mean, I could understand why there may still be some doubt out there about should I be a one-termer or not. But we won and went on to actually win, you know, four more times. Sam ran in 84. Sam ran once again because it had been such a razor-thin margin. That Sam decided to run against me again in 84. And this time, I felt a lot better. We got almost 70% of the vote. So
wow.
It was 68-something. Yeah.
What changed?
Well, I had some very good successes. We had a lot of real serious murder cases. And I tried the cases myself, even though I was the boss. I believed in... If I was going to ask for, and this was during the time that there were a lot of these cases were death penalty cases, and I figured if I was going to ask a jury to take a person's life, that ought to be tried by me, their elected DA, and that was my philosophy. During this 4-year period, we had some very serious murders, and I was successful in getting pretty much all convictions, but a fair share of death penalty cases. So, and this was a law and order community during that period of time. These were the Reagan years.
Was that an independent of party thing? It was just
no. It was party. The district attorney had to run as a party. I was a Republican.
No, well, I mean, when you say it was a law and order community,
well, I think we're seeing what you're seeing happening to Cobb County now. It's going back Democrat. It was just the reverse. When I was riding the wave in '76. Of starting to be a big Republican county.
And yeah, I mean, what I spoke to former Governor Roy Barnes recently after.
And I'm sure he would tell you that. Johnny Isaacson and I were elected together in '76. I got elected DA, and he got elected to the State House as a Republican.
Yeah, I bet y'all had started that.
Yeah.
So let's actually talk about that for a second. Just, you know, you mentioned when you, were here in Georgia, you. Got an interest in the Republican Party.
Yeah,
do you remember how that happened?
Well, my parents were Republicans. Okay. I was raised in a French-Irish Catholic family.
Yeah.
And all of the people I grew up with in Connecticut were John Kennedy fans, Democrats. And my dad was the only maverick. He was even a Republican who voted for Nixon. You know, so Republican has always been in my blood. And so when I moved down here, it looked even more hopeless than it did in Connecticut at the time, that this was a Democrat state. I mean, they had not had, since Reconstruction, a Republican win on a statewide basis. As a matter of fact, they did not have a Republican win on a countywide basis in Cobb County. I was the first. You see, the others were from Republican districts within the county.
Right.
And the commissioner, George Langford, was from the eastern, one of the eastern commission seats. But everything else was Democrats. So.
And even though you had to, state your party affiliation when running as district attorney, how partisan were the district attorney races? Like, did it mattered to a degree, obviously, because it hadn't happened before.
Right.
But did you run as a Republican, or did you run as yourself, but I happen to be a Republican?
More of that. I happen to be a Republican. I would never have probably won the Democratic primary against Buddy. He had primary opposition and won the primary handily.
Right.
I didn't have any, there were no other Republicans, so I didn't have any primary opposition.
Yeah.
And so I don't think Republican or Democrat really had anything much to do with it, other than we were able to identify and mobilize this great swell of new people moving into East Cobb who happened to be more Republican than Democrat.
Right.
And we got them out to vote, and that's why I won.
Right.
And in the years after, even that razor-thin re-election year, keep in mind, that's when Ronald Reagan beat Jimmy Carter. You know, ironically, I beat Buddy by more votes in 1976 when Jimmy Carter was elected president than I did in 1980 when Ronald Reagan won in a landslide, and I squeaked in. So, who knows? But in 84, it was Reagan's second term, and I had some successes, as I told you about. One thing that really helped at the end, and I think helped seal it, was I sued the State Board of Pardons and Parole in my capacity as district attorney. I was getting calls from victims' families that people were, and they're not just murders, robberies, you name it, that people were getting out of prison. They'd see them on the street, and they were never notified that this person was up for parole or had been released. I started studying the issue and found that there was a statute, a law in the state of Georgia that said that before the State Board of Pardons and Paroles can pardon or parole somebody if they had not served at least one-third of their sentence, they have to notify the victim and the local district attorney that this person is up for consideration. Mm-hmm. And there were literally thousands of these inmates who had been released with no notice in disregard of the lawsuit. So I filed a lawsuit against State Bar in my capacity as a district attorney. Sharon versus the State Board of Pardons and Parole. And I can't remember what year. I could find it in the books. I think it's 252 Georgia. But anyways, it was between 80 and 84. It was probably in the mid-80s. Because I won re-election in 80, and in 84 was the landslide, and I think it probably would have been 83, 84 I filed suit against the state board. Well, I had to file a suit in Fulton County. It's a civil suit, basically saying that they were violating the statute. And it was basically a mandamus saying, you can't release people until you notify the victim and the district attorney of the county they've been convicted in if they haven't served at least a third of their sentence. Mm-hmm. State board, so I sued them in Fulton County before a Superior Court judge in Fulton County. I think it was Judge Etheridge, I can't recall. Anyways, went down there for the hearing and basically got laughed out of court. He said, that's a ministerial statute. The State Board of Pardons and Paroles has unbridled authority to do whatever they want to do with an inmate. And he denied my mandamus. I immediately took it up to the Supreme Court of Georgia, who had seven justices at the time. It was a televised the press was on it, and I brought it up, argued my case. The state attorney general's office was against us, arguing on behalf of the State Board of Pardons and Paroles. And the decision came out about less than a year before my reelection, 7-0 in my favor.
Wow.
And the State Board of Pardons and Paroles had to then start notifying. And so it was a great issue to be able to run for re-election.
Right.
So I always felt that had certainly some impact.
With that landslide victory in 84.
Yeah. And then in subsequent elections in 88 and in 92 and 96, I didn't have any opposition. I then, in one of the last case I tried was the Fred Tokars case, and I don't know if you've heard about that, but that's the a lawyer who had his wife murdered, and
but he had asked that somebody murdered.
Yeah, he got his business partner to find somebody to actually murder her. They lived out in East Cobb. He was afraid he was in all sorts of illegal businesses. He was money laundering and all that. And he was afraid that she was going to divorce him. She was actually had a private investigator and all that. But long story short, he was afraid that she was going to turn him in, basically. So he had her killed. And she was murdered on coming home from visiting her parents in Florida on a Sunday. Excuse me. Hello? Hey, how you doing, Bill? Well, I've got a meeting at noon. I've got to be in. What time is it? Okay, I'm fine. Anyways, I'm still on for tonight, so. He's here today, but I haven't seen him yet. Okay. Whatever. All righty. Okay. Yep. Bye bye. Anyways, he had his wife murdered. And she was visiting. She was visiting the her parents in Bradenton, Florida, with two young boys, Ricky and Mike. They were 6 and 4 years old. And Fred said, he flew down to be with them during Thanksgiving, but then he said, I got to fly back because I got to visit. I got a client I have to visit on Sunday. So she was driving back on Sunday night after she left her parents alone. And he had it set up for the murder, the gunman, a guy by the name of Curtis Rohrer. He told him, you know, the sliding glass doors will be unlocked into the house, to where the house was. And the business partner, Eddie Lawrence, drove Curtis Rohrer out there. He said, what you need to do is make it look like a burglary. She'll drive in with the kids. He said, what do I do with the kids? And Fred said, they'll run to a neighbor's. Just don't hurt them, but they'll run to a neighbor. They'll be okay. He said, shoot her, make it look like she came in on a home invasion. Well, the bottom line is Curtis went out there, Eddie dropped him off. Curtis got scared. He hadn't been out of the city of Atlanta. He was a street thug from Atlanta. He'd never been to Marietta. East Cobb, of all places. And he goes ahead and makes, you know, he pulls out a few drawers, but nothing taken. And all of a sudden, she pulls into the garage with it and goes into the kitchen area. As she's pulling in, she gets out of her car, and Curtis meets her at this back stairs. Instead of doing what he was supposed to do, he didn't know how to get back to the car where Eddie was waiting for him. So he ordered her back into the car. Mike's in the back seat, the car seat, asleep. And Ricky's up front next to his mother. Curtis gets in the back seat and back of her. And he had a sawed-off shotgun, 410. And he orders her out. And she, you know, she's saying, I'll do anything, just don't hurt me and my boys. He said, and he gets on Powers Road, and he said, turn down that road. And it was a side road where she knew it was a cul-de-sac, a new houses under construction. She knew, she goes down there, they're not coming out. So she refused to do that, and he blew the back of her head off. The car came to rest in a field. Curtis jumped out, ran up the road, and by then Eddie had pulled out, and they went back to Atlanta. Ricky got his little brother out of the car, and they ran to a house where some boys were renting, young fellas were renting a house, and knock on the door. It's 10 o'clock on a Sunday night after Thanksgiving. Guys open the door, and here's two little boys, blood and brain matter all over them, saying, my mom is hurt, come for help. So they called it. And I'll never forget that evening, getting a call to come out to the crime scene. And I said, where is it? Thinking it's the normal places where murders happen. And they said, it's Powers Road, right off Johnson's Ferry. I said, wait a minute, something's wrong here. You're not going to have a violent murder in front of two little boys in that area of town. And this woman, she's got some means. I says, this is, you know, murders don't be wandering around the King's Cove neighborhood. I mean, yes, burglars, but there's something not right on this. And this was in 1991. And the bottom line is, we got Eddie Lawrence to flip. We tried Curtis Rohrer. It was a change of venue. We were in a little county, Columbia County, right outside of Augusta because of all the publicity on this case. And we had a rogue juror. And Curtis' trial was, yes, I did it. He confessed to killing, but he said it was accidental. When she wouldn't turn, the gun just went off. It jerked and went off. That was his defense. The jury goes out and couldn't reach a verdict of guilt. I mean, I'm asking for the death penalty. It was 11-1 to convict him. And one juror decides he's just not going to. He said, I'm. And they said, he's admitted. And he said, I'm just not going to vote for it. Why? It was juror nullification. He was an African American and was another African American. Uh-huh. That's the only thing I could ever get out of it. One of the jurors was so mad at him after the verdict. As we were leaving in the car, he flagged us down and got in next to me. We were driving back to the motel. And he was hyperventilating. He said, I'm so upset. He said, whatever you do, try this man again. And he told what went on in the jury room. Well, I said, well, it's time to try Fred. I mean, now it's 1996, early 97. Even though, and we'll get to Curtis after, we'll retry him, and, you know, because it was a hung jury, you could retry him.
If the jury's hung, let's say I were there and yeah. I were just categorically opposed to the death penalty. Yeah. Would that be a reason for
No. And that's what I also think is that he might have been just against the death penalty in general. But we hadn't even reached that. It was just guilt or innocence phase. Then you have a second phase.
So he was hanging it up before even getting
before it even got
issues
there.
Of how
right.
to punish him.
Right. I don't know. I just don't know. He seemed like a nice guy at the time, but I've seen jury nullification before.
Right.
So anyway, so we decided to try Fred, and then we'd get back to trying Curtis. Well, retrying Curtis. Well, we had almost a 3-month trial up in Lafayette, Georgia, so right just south of Chattanooga. Again, because of the publicity, it was on court TV, gavel to gavel. Day to day on court TV, and the jury convicted Fred for his role. I was asking for the death penalty. The jury went out after the penalty phase and hung up. And 10 were for the death penalty. Two older women would not. They said, "These boys have lost their mother. We're not going to take his father away, even though he's responsible for her death." Mm-hmm. But anyway, so he got a life sentence. And the bottom line is, a tragedy on the thing is, I've kept up with the boys over the years, and Rick is still with us. He's kind of jumped back and forth between some of his mother's sisters in California and in Florida. Mike just never could adjust. I don't know if it's because of the murder. He really didn't know much. He was 4 years old. Mm. But he went out west. His health got real bad. He was a journalist. He actually wrote for the Christian Science Monitor for a while in New York. And he ended up living as a homeless person in the park and was in such bad shape that when they found him, they brought him to a hospital out there. He got blood clots and died. Fred was still alive. Within a year, Fred died in prison. And so, it was a sad, sad case of a family. And Sarah was a wonderful person. She was a devout in her church. She was taught school there. Great mother, just married the wrong guy.
Yeah.
But anyways, that was the last case I tried, and we finished in March of 97. At the end of 97, I had been former president of the National DA's Association back in the early 90s. I was on the board of directors that hired the executive director of our National Association in Washington. And the NDAA had partnered with the Department of Justice, the Federal Department of Justice, in building a training center for federal prosecutors and state and local prosecutors known as the National Advocacy Center on the campus of the University of South Carolina. That's what I was telling you earlier. It was right on Pendleton Street, and the funding, at that time, the funding came from the Senate Judiciary Committee, of which Ernest Hollings was the chairman. That's why it went to South Carolina.
Okay.
And the other senator was a young guy by the name of Strom Thurmond.
Did you say a young guy by the name of Strom?
And his son now, Strom Jr., is district attorney right near Greenwood. He's in Aiken.
Oh, wow.
He's still the district attorney there.
Strom Thurmond,
yep.
Okay.
So anyway, or solicitor, they call him over there.
Right.
But it was being built, and it was going to be opening in May of 1998. And the executive director came to me, since I'd been doing a lot of training for him over the years for of prosecutors, he said, I want you to be the director of education. And I said, well, I'm just starting my sixth term here. I mean, I'm 2 years in. He said, look, I used to be the district attorney of Boston, Massachusetts. And he says, you know, there comes a time when those your votes are going to go away and you're going to get voted out of office. So leave before that happens. And so I said, you know, maybe I've done this too long. It's been 21 plus years. Talked to my wife. It was just a good time. And so I retired and went over there, and I was the director of education of training. It was a lot of fun training prosecutors from all 50 states. We'd fly them in. They'd be there for a week and do trial ad. We'd videotape them and critique them. And I was there for 6 years until 2004 when the executive director retired and they named me as executive director of the National DA's Association. So I went up to Washington for 4 years. At the end of 4 years, I said, oh, okay. At the end of 4 years, I said, you know, I've been 10 years now with the NDAA. It's time to go back to Marietta. That's our home. My wife was born here in Cobb County. The kids were just getting ready to go into middle school, elementary and middle school. I have a former wife and older kids, but these, I was kind of an old dad for kids. I had them at 46 and 48, you know.
Right.
So we came back and we put them in school down here, and I was just going to practice law. And went around, several of the lawyers wanted me to come in. And at that time, the Superior Court judges had just, had to retire out the court administrator. And so I went up just to say, hey, I'm back in town, judge. Half of the judges had been to my assistant, DA. Mary Staley Clark was one of my assistants, Adele Grubbs, Steve Schuster. Mm-hmm. And so I came up and just say, hey, I'm back in town. I've been gone 10 years. I'm going to be practicing law. And they start telling me that how they're in such a fix because they don't have a court administrator and, you know, the staff needs somebody. And I said, well, if there's anything I can do to help, you know how you say that, you don't mean it. But I wasn't gone an hour when I got a call from Lark Ingram, who was the chief judge. And she said, do you remember what you said back in the meeting? And I said, I can't remember anything. She said, well, you said if there's anything. She said, we got talking and your name's well known. A lot of the people know you up here. Until we can find, and you know, we're going to do a national search for a court administrator. But until, are you ready to practice law now, or could you give us a couple of months until we can find somebody? And I said, you know, I said, I don't know anything about court administration. I'm just an old prosecutor. I said, but I'll come on up if you think it will help. So we worked out a deal where I was just an independent contractor for 3 months. And I said, then I want to, you know, get moving on. Well, at the end of 3 months, I go in to see all the judges. I said, you know, my 3 months is up. I said, could you stay another 3 months? Get us, we've got to start working, looking for applicants. So I sent out a notice for applicants, stayed another 6 months. Now it's August. I started in February of 08. So now it's August, and I said, folks, it's time for me. You know, I've got to get started. I'm going to be 60 next year. And they said, well, you know, we got a bunch of applicants, and why don't you just keep it? And I said, well, I don't know. And then, you know, they said, well, you get insurance and all that. And I said, I went home, talked to my wife, and I said, well, I guess I'll do it. I said, maybe another year or two, and we'll see what happens. Well, that was 12 years ago, so I'm finally retiring. So that's the story of my life. So there you go.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that.
I'm sorry for being so long-winded, but
this is how I prefer having my interviews done. It's just the fact that a local paper with only a handful of reporters. You know, I don't get to spend this kind of time with people.
Well, it's been an interesting career. It really has, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. There were some wild and woolly days here in this county.
And so why retire now? Why not at 65, 7 years ago, or however long that was? Why retire now?
Well, I'm 71. I'll be 72 in March. I just, you know, for the last 2 years, I've been saying, you know, I don't want to be here when people are starting to say, when's that old guy going to leave, you know? And we have a third of our judges are brand new judges coming in. It's time. They're younger judges. The technology and the way they conduct business is foreign to me. It's good what's happening. In a lot of ways, I think because of COVID, we've learned to do things a lot more efficiently. And I think even once the pandemic's over, you're going to see a lot of the virtual hearings and way we do virtual filings of documents, that's going to be the norm. And so it's a good time now for them to make a change. And so I told them, you know, it's time at the end of the year. And I've got some other interests that I want to do. I still want to do some trial ad training once they start it up again. I do it for New York. I do it for Georgia. Some law schools.
Trial advocacy training?
Trial advocacy, yeah. Cross examination, direct opening arguments, closing arguments, things like that. I have been involved in the building of this courthouse, doing needs assessments. So I have been talking with some companies that are bidding for new courthouses or remodeling of courthouses around Georgia. Mm-hmm. I would be happy to work with them as a consultant. I think I know the needs of judges and prosecutors and defense lawyers. So I'm going to keep my hand in that. I may even do a little, you know, who knows, public speaking and who knows, I may write some of my memoirs. I don't know if anybody want to hear them. But anyways, that's kind of what I think I may do.
Very cool.
Thanks, Alex, and Happy New Year once again from the Marietta Daily Journal podcast. Now remember, hindsight is now 2020, and we only have a few days left until the January 5th election. Thank you for listening to the Marietta Daily Journal podcast, produced by BG Ad Group in Marietta, Jacob Sutherland, director. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast and get the latest hyper-local news and information from Cobb County's news source, the Marietta Daily Journal.
This podcast is brought to you in part by AM 920 The Answer, Atlanta's home for news, opinion, and insight. Just go to am920theanswer.com to listen live. That's am920theanswer.com.
Looking for a way to find out what's going on in your neighborhood and across the North Atlanta suburbs? Now you can get the hyper-local news you need anytime. In Cobb County, check out the Marietta Daily Journal podcast. Live a bit farther east, then the North Fulton Neighbor podcast has you covered. And Gwinnett County folks, be sure to listen to the Gwinnett Daily Post podcast. We didn't forget our friends in Cherokee County. The Cherokee Tribune Ledger News podcast has all your local news, too. You can find these podcasts wherever you get your podcasts, so subscribe and share the only hyper-local news podcast for your area, brought to you by the BG Podcast Network.